everybody and their brother is putting out their shingle as a coach in some sort of product related way. And you've got generative AI offering advice. So now I feel like it's very crowded. For me, that means even more getting clear about who do I think I can best help. One of the things that a lot of the clients that I work with value is they feel very isolated in their companies. Like there aren't a lot of people at their companies that they can be vulnerable. And like, I'm not really sure what to do here. You have to portray a lot of confidence as a product leader in a role that hasn't existed very long. And there's a lot of organizational context that you need to unpack to diagnose and make decisions. So I think maybe that's something that generative AI can't quite do yet, is like really help you diagnose your own situation, people, team, leadership, culture.
Welcome to the Unlearn Podcast, where host Barry O'Reilly seeks to synthesize the superpowers of extraordinary individuals to think big, start small, and learn fast. Here's your host, Barry O'Reilly.
Welcome to the Unlearn Podcast. On this show, I'm delighted to be joined by Hope Gurion, founder of Fearless Product, where she helps and advises product leaders and teams on product management best practices. Now, Hope has a fascinating career. She was involved in the internet from the various early stages, from working with Discovery and AOL, really in the formation of the internet and how we might build and use products. After that, she got to spend time at Jobster and Career Builder, and also Beachbody, where everybody, I'm sure, had to go with doing insanity. Today, she now helps product leaders with Fearless Product and also hosts her own fantastic podcast that I highly recommend you listen to. But before we understand more about what she's doing today, let's go back to the earliest days of her own career and how she got started at the earliest stages of the internet.
When I was at AOL, so this is years ago, I had been in, it was called the Business Affairs Group, doing contract negotiations. And I worked with a number of companies who were creating their first digital experiences on the internet in the form of AOL proprietary programming languages, and negotiating these contracts really tooth and nail to get the very best terms for AOL anyway. And then when it got sort of handed over the wall for the implementation, nobody paid attention to the contract. They did whatever they wanted and nobody in our teams read the contract. So I was like, okay, this is pointless. So I'm going to move on to the actual channels part of the business to like really create experiences with a lot of brand name companies that make sense and create value for AOL. At the time, one of the issues for AOL was it was kind of like a pass-through. If you were Nickelodeon and you wanted to make your content available to the AOL audience, there would be like kind of sort of something on AOL, but pretty much you're being passed right through to the Nickelodeon web experience. So how does that create a sustainable value prop? Like it was internet on training wheels, right? Like that was sort of the reputation for AOL. So that made me a little crazy. I wasn't in a very powerful position at AOL, so there's only so much I could do. But anyway, I ended up going into what were called the verticals. One of the verticals that I was responsible for was AOL shopping. And so AOL shopping, Best Buy, and like, I can't even remember all the different Macy's, all these different retailers were in the shopping experience. I worked with a woman, Gina D'Andrea. She was amazing. She was like my sales partner and I was like the product person. And we were trying to figure out how do we create an experience that companies are willing to pay for and create some reason for people to go shopping on AOL, right? Like, why would you go shopping on AOL? Like, you could Google Macy's, you could Google Best Buy, whatever. That challenge of having to like really think through what's the value proposition? How are we going to create an experience that makes sense for the retailer, makes sense for the consumer, and makes sense for AOL's business model? Like, was something that was a fun challenge to work on. I could tell you more about that, but one of the other moments that I remember was having to communicate with the designers and engineers at AOL about how we were creating this. And that it was actually the design lead, I won't name him because I still have hard feelings, who insisted on a PRD. I kid you not, insisted on a PRD. And I can remember writing down all the words, a million things, handing over the PRD. And then however many months later, I was seeing the first designs and like what was coming through. And I was like, but this is not at all what I described. And I had gone into great care to make sure there was like the value proposition for the consumer and like what was the way the brands were differentiated and why was it going to be compelling. And when I pointed out, like, but this has nothing to do with the PRD, the very same document that you insisted on me creating, there was a real uncomfortable and like loss of trust in that relationship. And it taught me so much about co-creation. Like, I was co-creating with my head of sales very, very well, but I wasn't co-creating very well with the head of design. And my engineering partner at the time was the one who was paying attention to what I was saying. But the designers, in this case, they wanted a lot of white space and they wanted the brands to only submit images in a certain way and to showcase their products in a certain way. It just made me crazy because I was like, these are the things that are going to bring money, bring differentiation, and very little of it has to do with the designs of how you want these brands' products to be presented. And so it was just like a learning moment for me in terms of, do you really have shared vision? Does everybody on the team really understand the business context of what we're trying to do? Do we really know what the important constraints are for how we're making decisions? It was just a sort of early learning moment in my product portion of my career.
Just to paint the picture, right? This is a fascinating time in just tech anyway. You're talking like early 2000s, where even the internet is sort of finding its feet in some respects.
Yeah.
AOL obviously being one of the main companies helping to shape that. Those experiences to me, they're fascinating. My first chance to do that is I was in university. I could go to San Francisco and I got a job at citysearch.com in its earliest stages where people would pay $50 and we would go around and take photos of their cafe and then they would have barryscafe.citysearch.com and they were on the internet, you know? And it was like, yes, I could write HTML. So I was a highly proficient coder at that stage.
Yes,
like you had to write HTML bracket, you know, whatever. For me, it was one of those moments that just got me excited about the potential. Yes, things were hard. It was difficult to do. The technology was still crap and in its infancy. But also, as you're describing, like even the methods to build great products were still very siloed in nature. You were focused on helping build out the brand, the sales, the value prop. And then I would pass to an engineering and design team that would magically go off for 18 months and come back with exactly what we, you know, envisaged. They were the dynamics of the time, if you will. These patterns that maybe people are probably more familiar with today, there's still plenty of companies living in that world of siloed teams, lack of cross-functional groups, and their disciplines working together. So you've sort of seen all of that in an exciting way. What's even more fascinating to me is that, as you said, we started in AOL in much more focused around building the brands, the go-to-market, doing contract negotiations with suppliers. You saw these problems and power to you. You were like, I'm going to actually go be that product person rather than just sort of sign the sales deals and send them over the wall and then go like, what's going on? Went on to become the chief product officer of Career Builder, one of the largest, I suppose, sourcing sites that is in North America for sure.
At one time.
When you were there, of course, when you were there.
When I was there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Mm-hmm.
You had that experience as you described with AOL, and then you made this shift. You also started in a business development role as you went into that company and then went on to lead product. So tell us a little bit about some of that transition. Just from your own perspective, what led you to move into that domain and then also go from one group of the business into actually leading the product development of it?
So that's another funny sort of AOL history story. When I was at AOL, before I did shopping, one of the verticals that I oversaw was jobs and careers. And we switched from Monster as being our anchor tenant, like sole supplier for that vertical, to Career Builder. And so I got to know the Career Builder team. The CEO, Matt Ferguson, asked me at one point to come out and do a talk at their company about like internet best practices, because I worked at AOL. Nice. I mean, this is very early days. We actually had an in-house user research studio, almost like for focus groups, but we were doing usability testing very early on. Like we would sit behind the two-way mirror. Somebody was like going through the experience. And so
everybody crying, like the button's over there. Click on the button. We put it over there.
So true. So I asked the UX team, I was like, I got to go give this talk about like internet best practices. Do you have any like screenshots or things that we've learned doing the usability testing at AOL? And so I basically copied the slides, created a presentation, went to Career Builder, gave this talk, and all of a sudden, I'm an expert at internet.
That's how easy it is, folks. Yeah, damn right. I love it.
There you go. Yeah. Copy the right slides. Anyway, we kept in touch. A couple of years later, he was like, you know, I really think you would like our company. Yeah, I think it would be great if you wanted to come and lead our marketing team. And I was like, no, I was pregnant. I'm like, I'm not going to move to Chicago. My husband working here. Anyway, I turned it down. But he was very persistent and very nice about it. And he said, well, if you're ever not loving what you're doing, give me a call. And so I had gone to a startup in Seattle. And then it was, we can talk about Jason Goldberg and Jobster if you're interested in that train wreck. But anyway, then I was like, you know, Matt, I'm not loving what I'm doing. And I flew out to Chicago and then I ended up, he created a role for me. So that's why it was like VP of Business Development. He basically created a role for me because the marketing role had been filled. And I really took my job as business development means looking for ways to increment business at the company, not like doing partnerships. And so he'd given me sort of a random assortment of like the ad sales team and like a nascent team that had like a sort of a niche job site and government relations. I ended up setting up a lobbying group. So I had this mishmash of responsibilities, but the ones that like lit me up were, how can I find ways to grow the business? Like, where are customers spending money? What are the core competencies and assets that we have? How might we be able to like recombine those into potential growth opportunities for the company? That is what led into more product development related initiatives. Over time, as those were being built out, I am proud of the fact that we diversified our revenue from one large product, the job site. And that ended up over time being only 50% of our revenue at a time that we really had diversified our offerings. And so that's how I became chief product officer, because we had built out so many other products and services to have a more diversified portfolio.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing story. Even going through that transition yourself, again, this is like 7-8 years ago. The notion of even a chief product officer, I still think, is probably in its infancy at that stage. It wasn't necessarily a tech companies were starting to realize it wasn't just like sales and engineering, that there was people that had to essentially orchestrate what you might hear in the market to lines of code, to like people using the thing and creating this sort of great virtuous business loop. Tell us a little bit about even what it felt like to become, if you will, like a chief product officer at that stage. Who could you talk to about what you were doing? Who were the people like between Chicago and San Francisco now at this stage? And what were your ways of sanity checking your thinking about what you were doing? Like, you're sort of plotting a path for this very successful company where there's not a lot of road signs even that exist at the time. What were some of the challenges with that? And how did you go about filling the gaps there?
I want to say maybe it was around 2012 or something when I was overseeing product. I can't remember if it was VP of product and then it became chief product officer. I can't remember the details. But right around like 2014 or so, Marty Kagan was a big influence. He came and did his sort of, call it the Marty Kagan bitch slap. It was like, Everything your company is doing is not the way it should be. It's wrong.
It's wrong.
But also, here's a path forward. And right around that time, also, I got involved with a group. It was called Creative Good at the time. Now it's called Collaborative Gain, that Phil Terry oversees. And it was when I was in those discussions with people who were leading products. They were CTOs or heads of engineering. Mostly it was CPO or ish and CTO ish people from a different set of companies, all trying to navigate the, like, how do we get our teams making good decisions? How do we get our peers on the leadership team making good decisions? How do we support our teams for success? And this sort of really fantastic community of people with humility, but also experience and advice.
Yeah, yeah.
It just changed the game for me in terms of having people that I trusted, could learn from. Eventually, I had things that I could share with them too that they could find value in, not immediately. It was just a huge asset to me as a leader, especially first time that role existed in the company, first time me doing that role early in the days of that role even existing. And I'm still involved in that organization. I moderate the Product Leader Council now. So that was a huge, huge learning experience for me.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people, it's actually, it's kind of topical and top of mind for me at the moment. Some people in my network have been asking a lot about, where are places I can go to learn from peers? I'm in this sort of made up role of Chief Incubation Officer in our venture studio, which again is something that is a bit of an emergent sort of space. There's some best practices, but a lot of it is reliant on speaking to people who are doing it and sort of sharing all our mistakes with one another and going, look, don't do this one again. And I've even caught myself numerous times falling into traps like, oh, we forgot to spend and ask the question about who our real customer is for this product, or we've fallen into the trap that we needed to focus on a niche and suddenly we're building this massive monolithic platform that's going to compete with a company that's like Series D funded and 7,000 employees and we're like two people in a room, you know? All these little moments, the traps you just easily fall into yourself. And sort of having people around you to pressure test your thinking, to share the stress and anxiety doing the roles, like everything that sort of goes with it. Tell us a little bit about how it's helped you, if you will, and maybe even ways you might recommend for other people who are doing these roles that are often emerging and they're going forward. Because again, you've sort of evolved into now helping people with that as well, which is kind of interesting in its own right.
I think there's multiple ways people can learn. They can read books and learn secondhand from people's experiences or watch videos or whatever. There's ways that you can learn by just using your best judgment through trial and error and seeing how it plays out for you. But for me, I felt like the ability to hear firsthand from somebody's experience about a situation that you're encountering that they have navigated, maybe successfully, maybe not so successfully, but both have value. There's just a high degree of trust. There's a high degree of believability in what they're sharing, right? Like there's no reason for them to not be honest because you're in the space that really values people being authentic and sharing their experiences, whether they have it all figured out or where they don't. And when you can get those different perspectives, you know, the best case scenario is multiple people have experience something that you're navigating, like you're setting up your first team structures or you're trying to convince the CEO that maybe the idea that they have is, you know, not worth investing tons of time and effort into. Like lots of different experiences that people can help you navigate. And for me, that was like the perfect combination of how do I get really credible advice, internalize it, and then turn it into action for me. It just accelerated my learning curve. And so that's why I think it's a valuable asset for people who are willing to be vulnerable and participate in a community like that.
I think it's awesome. There's so many aspects to this, recognizing that you can't do it all on your own, recognizing that there are actually other communities where you can, as you say, be vulnerable, put the things I don't know out there and have people go, oh yeah, I was there, or yeah, I don't know that either. It is invaluable. But then the other piece, and I'm a huge believer in this, and focus on having numerous, is like coaching and support. And what's again even fascinating with your story is you've had the chance to do these roles. You grew up with the internet in AOL. Like, you've got to work at Jobster, which is a startup. And as you say, like, I'm sure there's loads of war stories from there. Career builder to have this phenomenal success. One of my favorite things that you've been part of is Beachbody. And because I just remember doing Insanity in my living room in London with my wife endlessly to try and remain fit at one stage of my life. But you shifted into this role of then becoming a coach for other people with your Fearless product business and also your fantastic podcast that you do, which are all experience reports often from like product leaders actually answering these difficult questions. So for you, what triggered that shift? And maybe what were some of the things you had to unlearn in a way from being the leader of these companies then to actually helping teams and leaders build these types of systems and structures to improve their product capabilities? What were like the first few months like when you sort of went from an operator to then leveraging a lot of this insight and coaching that you'd been learning from what you were putting yourself through?
I didn't know that's what I was going to do. Like many people, right? It wasn't like, oh, as soon as this is done, I'm totally going into coaching. Like, that wasn't how it was, right?
Yeah.
For me, the path was when I was at Career Builder, one of the constraints that was real and put on me was, yes, you're leading products and doing business development, adding products, whatever. But one of the constraints that my CEO put on me was, you're going to take people in the company who know our business well, know our customers well, we think they're good people worth investing in, and we're going to put them in your group and you're going to figure out what to do with them.
Oh, great.
So like, I never got to, I mean, eventually I did, but for a while, if I needed to grow something, I wasn't like going out and hiring externally. I had to do a lot of training and development of people from sales backgrounds, marketing backgrounds, engineering backgrounds, finance backgrounds into product related roles. So I think while it was a bizarre constraint, that constraint ended when we started building out our UX function. That was the like, okay, let's train a salesperson to be a product designer. Anyway, to me, helped me realize that there's some roles where I think you can train somebody into it and other types of roles where that's not going to be so easy. But I felt like for product leader roles, I think it is coachable and trainable. I do. Then after leaving Beachbody and deciding like, what do I want to go do? One of the things that I was asked to do by people who knew me was to do some like interim consulting or advising or whatever. So I got a taste for it. And I was like, oh, maybe this is a thing that I could do. And I had been working with Teresa Torres for a long period of time. And she also was like, well, if you're going to do this independently, then maybe we could do stuff together. That's sort of how I ended up creating a coaching business. But knowing what types of skills I think are coachable and trainable, and knowing that was something that I got a lot of satisfaction doing, and I had seen a lot of different scenarios, is what gave me confidence that I could do this to a certain segment of people.
You're doing a great job at it. There's no two ways about it. And it's great to see you sharing what you're learning and the people who work with you are learning, like back with the community, right? That's always a special part of it. So for you, what was the thing that was most counterintuitive or sort of flipped on your head when you started to do coaching in that specific role, as opposed to like being responsible for like, obviously, some sort of growth metrics for a business, right? With a CEO sort of knocking on the door going, how's Q4 looking? Are we going to hit the numbers?
Yeah, I have that. I answer to myself on that now, right? Like, I mean, can I still do this? My bar was when I was starting out, I was like, okay, so if I took a full-time job, I'd want to make sure the cash compensation was X, because equity is always a wild card. So as long as my cash compensation covers this bar, then it's a viable way of earning a living. And do I like what I'm doing? Do I feel like I'm helping people? Do I have flexibility and autonomy, which is something I felt like I was lacking when I was so committed to, are we going to hit our numbers? Is everybody doing what they're supposed to be doing? It's draining after
a while. No, it's a treadmill. No two ways about it.
It's hard.
Yeah.
Product leaders, you know, that like you don't hear a lot about when things are going well. You're there to solve the problems. So that was my bar. And I was able to pass that bar through a little bit of luck and a little bit of timing and good relationships. And at the time, there weren't a lot of product leader coaches. I think the challenge now is that everybody and their brother is putting out their shingle as a coach in some sort of product related way. And you've got generative AI offering advice. So now I feel like it's very crowded. For me, that means even more getting clear about who do I think I can best help. One of the things that a lot of the clients that I work with value is they feel very isolated in their companies. Like there aren't a lot of people at their companies that they can be vulnerable. And like, I'm not really sure what to do here. You have to portray a lot of confidence as a product leader in a role that hasn't existed very long. And there's a lot of organizational context that you need to unpack to diagnose and make decisions. So I think maybe that's something that generative AI can't quite do yet, is like really help you diagnose your own situation, people, team, leadership, culture. That's where I feel like I still have some room to offer advice.
Absolutely, right. It's one of the best things about when you are a true product leader, you're practicing your methods on yourself, both how you design your business, but even like listening to you describe, this is the niche. This is the place where I can offer support that maybe nobody else can. You can hear the differentiation, even just the way you talk about it. So looking ahead then for you, what are some of the things you're most excited about? Sure, generative AI is going to come and take all our jobs. So hopefully we can all retire sooner, I would hope. That's the viewpoint I'm taking.
I'm like, when is generative AI going to empty my dishwasher? That's what I want to know.
Exactly. Yeah, for you, like, you're right in this stuff. You know, you're doing great work in product discovery realm. You're helping a lot of people. What are some of the things that you're excited about that you're seeing on the horizon?
Yeah, I think I'll be excited when this tech session, like the belt loosen a little more, because there's been a whole lot of belt tightening after a whole lot of overspending and exuberance. I think it will kind of level out, hopefully sooner rather than later. Yeah. And I think that will get back to more measured decision making. There was a, let's just throw people at it. Let's just throw money at it. Everything's a good idea. Let's go crazy. And then now there's been like course correction, you know, the pendulum. I've seen this pendulum shift back and forth so many times. At the end of the day, fundamentals are always, who is our customer? What are their alternatives to using the thing we think they should be using? What's our angle in? Why do we think that doesn't work for them? And I think the more people can recognize that, frame their decisions around that, the more alignment, the more forward progression. And that's where I try to help both at the team level and the product leader level get more people operating off the same songbook, because there's lots of opinions to navigate.
True that. It's been great to hear some of your opinions today. Just even to follow your journey, it's a fascinating story of twists and turns. It's great to see how you have always sort of followed, if you will, what your intuition is and turned that into great roles. So thank you for sharing that with folks. I highly recommend everybody checks out your podcast. It's a great podcast. Everybody can find you on all good record stores, I'm sure, on the internet. We'll put all of them in the show notes. Thank you very much, Hope, for joining us. It's super to talk to you.
Thanks, Barry. A lot of fun.
Hey, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that show, but I'm even more delighted to share the exciting news. I've recently co-founded a new venture studio named Nobody Studios. Now, a venture studio is a vehicle for the rapid creation of new companies, from ideation to acceleration and growth. And our purpose at Nobody Studios will be to de-risk pre-seed stage business ideas. We'll do this by minimizing the time, speed, and capital involved in validating truly repeatable and scalable business models before any significant venture investment. We've an audacious goal to start 100 compelling companies over the next 5 years, and who knows how many beyond that. So if you're interested in radically changing the way work is done, how products are created,
Companies built and funded, even democratizing the wealth creation and how returns are distributed, this could be the business for you. We're looking for talent, capital, and influence. If you wish to contribute any or all of these, just get in touch. You can follow us on nobodystudios.com, on our LinkedIn page, all the social media accounts, or simply my newsletters and what I'm sharing. We'll be launching a truly innovative crowdfunding campaign, and I'd be honored if you'd be willing to join us on this journey and become a nobody yourself.